Welcome everybody to another episode of Amplify Your Business. Today we're going to be talking about whiskey. Okay, so we're back to having some drinks on Amplify Your Business, which you know makes me happy. And so if you guys want to have a drink as well, then we'll tell you how to get your hands on some of this stuff later on. But with me today is Nathan Flynn. He is the founder and CEO of Fort Distillery. So welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
Okay, so yeah, let's do this right off the top. So you've given me, sent a little care package, which I absolutely love. So I've got two here, a classic old fashioned, and I have a lemon gin martini. And this is under your brand, Tumbler and Rocks, right?
Yeah,
so tell
yeah,
me absolutely. First a little bit about the brand, and then give me a little rundown on these two concoctions.
Yeah, totally. So Tumbler and Rocks is our line of ready to serve cocktails. So back in, it would have been 2019. At that point, we had vodka, we had gin, we had a couple liqueurs, but we really saw the rise of the ready to serve, ready to drink category, right? Think like White Claw, nude, neutral. And so we knew we wanted to get into that game because it's a high volume, high growth category. And we kind of looked at the market and everybody was doing something similar, right? There's a lot of canned cocktails, you know, vodka sodas, hard seltzers, hard ciders, that kind of product. But we didn't see a lot of people focusing on spirit forward cocktails. So like an old fashioned, a Cosmo, a Manhattan. And so we made the decision. We said, hey, instead of entering this really crowded space of canned cocktails, let's go after the bottled cocktail space where there's far fewer competitors. At the time, there was really only one national competitor and not a lot of other stuff going on. So we decided to go after that market. We called it Tumbler and Rocks because all you need is a tumbler, which is a glass, and rocks, yeah, which is ice. Yeah. And so these cocktails are designed to be poured over ice and enjoyed. You don't have to mix anything in them. They're good to go. We made them at a kind of the perfect alcohol concentration. So when you pour it over ice, it slowly gets diluted. So you can actually enjoy the cocktail for, you know, 15 minutes. It's not watered down right away. So that's a bit about the brand. Super easy way to enjoy a cocktail. We wanted to introduce people to cocktail culture, you know, who might not have experienced it before, right? If I went to your house and said, hey, make me an old fashioned,
yeah,
or a Manhattan, maybe an old fashioned, but a Manhattan or a martini, you'd probably say, I don't really have the ingredients, or I don't know how, right?
Yeah.
With Tumbler and Rocks, you just open a bottle and pour it and away you go.
Yeah, love it. Okay, so I just poured myself the lemon gin martini.
Perfect. So that's what I'll have too.
You're gonna have the same thing? Okay.
Yeah. So the two that you've got there, old fashioned is our top selling cocktail. It's whiskey based. So it's whiskey, bitters, and then a bit of Demerara sugar. And so, the bitters we actually make in house. So it's our own bitters recipe. The Demerara sugar we use instead of white sugar. So normally an old fashioned would have like a sugar cube in it. Yeah. We use Demerara sugar, which is like brown sugar, but even darker. And so it gives it a little bit more like a molasses character to it.
Yeah.
Yep. And then the lemon gin martini is actually our newest cocktail. So we used to have a cocktail. We used to have a daiquiri. And it just didn't sell very well. And so we decided to replace it with something new. So the lemon gin martini is, you know, I kind of say it's what you want a martini to taste like. I feel like a lot of people don't realize that martinis are just like straight booze.
Yeah.
And so people order a martini and then drink it and they're like, oh my gosh, it's so strong, right? So we took a classic martini. We added a little bit of lemon juice, a little bit of simple syrup to it to, you know, tone it down a little bit. So I say this is, it's what you want a martini to taste like. So it's gin, lemon juice, and simple syrup. And it's our gin that we distill here at the distillery.
Awesome. Well, cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Oh, that is nice.
Yeah, it's super refreshing, right? It's got a little bit of that tartness from the lemon juice. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that is really nice.
Yeah, so that's our newest one. And it's gaining popularity quite quickly.
I love the bottles, these little bottles that you have too, nice glass bottles. And
thank
so,
you.
Yeah, is that something that you're very intentional about in terms of the way that you're packaging it?
Yeah, so branding is very important to us, how we sort of present ourselves and our brands to the world. And so I feel like one of the differences between our company and a lot of other craft distilleries is that we focus on building brands. And so, you know, we didn't call the cocktails Fort Distillery cocktails, right? We called them Tumbler and Rocks, right? We came up with a new brand identity for them. Same with our whiskey, Mountain Pass Whiskey, right? It's not called the Fort Distillery Whiskey. It's Mountain Pass Whiskey. It has its own identity. And so we put a lot of thought and intention into each of our product lines. Mm. And so the cocktails, you know, they're in a nice glass bottle, a little bit higher end.
Yeah.
You know, the paper label gives us some of that texture. And so we put a lot of thought and time and effort into what our product looks like and what's the story behind it. We actually do have plastic bottles too. You know, you can see here on the video. So we have our cocktails in a plastic bottle as well. And that's more like we used to call it kind of our adventure series, right? It's the same cocktails, but works really well for golf courses to bring in hotels, resorts. The plastic just works a little bit better than the glass in terms of the weight and the durability and stuff like that. We're also talking with some airlines as well, and they obviously prefer the plastic because of weight. So we kind of have both of those options, but regardless, both of them look good. You know, the plastic isn't like a cheap, you know, product. It still, you know, kind of has that quality feel to it.
Yeah, completely. Well, and I have to tell you that at our Christmas party last year for the staff, we did the, you know, gift exchange and so on. And one of the gift exchanges that somebody put in, and so we do that, the rotational one, right?
Where you can see it
from the other person and so on, was one of your multi-packs of your cocktails.
Mm, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that 3-pack probably that we did in the black box last year.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what it was. Yeah. And that one got stolen by, you know, around and around and around. Yeah. And I had it for a split second before somebody else had taken it. So you definitely have packaged up something that's desirable anyway.
Awesome.
Yeah, good on you for that. Well, okay. So let's get into some of the questions then. So what I usually like to start with is, you know, a question around what you think as an entrepreneur who's been at this for a bit, what you feel is the most important things that other entrepreneurs should know before or, you know, in the midst of their entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll kind of talk about, I think, the three things that I think are some of the most important, things in my entrepreneurship journey and for new or current entrepreneurs to know. So one is what we've already sort of talked about, is the branding piece.
Yep.
So that was definitely a mistake that I made when we first started the company. I put a lot of time and effort into the creation of the products, being the recipe, how we distill it, you know, the equipment we use to distill it. You know, I made tons of batches of vodka, tasting them, trying them, getting other people to taste them. Same with the gin. But I put hardly any time into what they were going to look like, and what the label would look like, and what the story was behind it, and how we present it to the world. And that was a big mistake on our part. We, you know, kind of my mindset, and I feel like the mindset of a lot of entrepreneurs is, if I build something cool or delicious or whatever it is, you know, people are going to buy it. And that's usually not the case, right? People shop with their eyes. They hear the story and they feel compelled. And so now when we launch a product, we probably, the ratio I would say is like 70 to 30. So like 70% of our time is spent on branding, on marketing, on our story. And then 30% of our time is spent on, okay, what's the product actually going to taste like?
Yeah.
Because to be honest, once you get into it, that part's easier, right? You make, you know, with the lemon gin martini, we spent an afternoon trying different recipes and we're like, this one's the best. Everybody likes it. Cool. Let's go. Right. Whereas the branding behind it, you know, days and weeks, not of constant work, but it's something I'm always thinking about, right? Like, who's our target market? What do the bottles need to look like? What's the story? And so that's sort of a big thing that I think a lot of entrepreneurs should maybe shift a little bit of their focus on. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're preaching to the choir here, because as a marketing guy, I love to hear people talk about the importance of marketing, obviously, but I mean, it's rooted in reality, just like you said. I mean, once you have a product or a service, it's really about the story, weaving that around that's going to differentiate you from the rest of the competition. Yeah. And oftentimes, and this is what we find all the time when we're working with different clients, is it's not necessarily the best product in the category that wins. It's the one that has the best marketing, best branding, best story. Yeah. And so, I'm glad that you've recognized that. And that's a really important one that, you know, we live in every day, basically. Yeah. But you were going to share a story.
We kind of joke at the distillery. So, you know, craft distilleries are kind of following craft breweries in the trend, where there wasn't a lot of them. And then, you know, suddenly it spiked. And so we're kind of in the middle of one of those spikes where there's, you know, a new distillery opening all the time. And we kind of joke here, you know, we see a new one open, you know, we pull up their website or Instagram or whatever, and all we do is look at the bottles and we immediately know, we're like, okay, these people didn't put any care and effort into their bottles. And so we kind of dismiss them. We're like, not even a competitor, not a problem. But then we'll see ones where it's like, oh, like, we can actually tell that they put a lot of time and effort. The bottle looks good. The presentation is good. And those are the people that we reach out to and say, hey, like, I'm Nathan. You want to meet up? Because it's a pretty tight knit community. It's not like, oh, go crush the new guy. It's more like, you know, how can we help each other and stuff? So we do really judge like the quality of other companies based on what they present to the world. So, so that's one big thing. The second thing I wanted to bring up is mentorship. So, mentorship has been hugely important in my entrepreneurial journey and was hugely lacking in the first couple of years. And I kind of look back at a lot of the mistakes I made and I recognize that if I had had somebody or a group of people to talk to about, you know, my decisions and what I was doing, I could have saved a lot of money, you know, grown a lot quicker. When I launched, I didn't have any partners, like it was just me. And so a lot of the decisions that I made were just, well, I think this is best, right? And so now I've built a great mentorship group. I'm part of a couple like mentor groups, and it's been hugely beneficial to me. And so that's one thing that I really wish, if I could go back, you know, I would have specifically sought out a mentor or mentors kind of right at the beginning of my journey.
Yeah. And I hear this across the board, actually, but where I hear most people really jumping on that mentorship program early on are in the startup tech space. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to hear more people outside of those incubators mm-hmm. now actually talking about it. And so it's kind of spilling into the mainstream, I guess you could say. And so I love to hear what you're doing. And so in terms of finding those mentors, you said you've joined some groups. Mm-hmm. Can you share with our audience how you were able to find the groups or the mentors that you wanted to, just in case they also want to?
Yeah. So what kind of started my search for mentorship, I guess, was the rapid growth of our company when we launched Tumblr and Rocks. That was our first kind of breakthrough product, if you will, that kind of took us on that upward trajectory. And we went from, you know, basically 1.5 staff to five to seven full-time people, you know, 10 part-timers. Like it was a really within like a year. And I felt as the owner, I felt very overwhelmed and didn't know what I was doing. And so that's sort of when I sought out mentorship. One of the first things I did was I took a course, not really a course, but something called ATBX. So it's run by the bank, by ATB. It's sort of like their accelerator program. I believe it was like an 8 or 12 week thing where you meet once a week. And each week, you know, they kind of had a different learning piece. So one day was branding, one day was finance, one day was you know, operations. They just kind of went over like the whole basics of entrepreneurship. And that was a very helpful course. And that's actually where I found two other mentorship pieces. So one of the groups I was introduced to through ATBX was called VMSA. And so it stands for Venture Mentorship something or other. And so I'm part of the Calgary group, even though I'm based in Edmonton. There is an Edmonton group as well, but you have to be connected to the University of Alberta, which I didn't go there. So I couldn't join that one. But that has been a hugely beneficial program for me. It's a group of three mentors that meet with you on every 6 weeks. And you just kind of go through the struggles of entrepreneurship. That one is more for personal growth and development. So you don't really talk like hard business problems. That one's more like leadership and, you know, work-life balance and that kind of stuff. And then the other group that I was in or that I am in is called the Entrepreneurs Organization. And so I joined their accelerator program last year and ran through that. And that was game-changing for me as well. Just a ton of learning, a lot of people to bounce ideas off of. And so that's sort of what I've done to get some of that mentorship.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah.
And so what would be number three then?
Yeah. So then that third one is kind of interesting, is kind of a mindset switch on your time. So this actually came from one of my good friends who owns a business, but he looks at, as the CEO, he looks at all of his hours as billable. And so he looks at his time as really specifically time is money, right? And that was a real kind of game changer for me, especially when it came to delegation, right? Like I looked at the value of our business and, you know, looked at how many hours I put in and, you know, not to be presumptuous, but I said, okay, my time is worth quite a lot, right? Like I've built a pretty significant company in 4 years with this much time. So each hour that I spend growing the business is hugely beneficial. And that helped me to cut a lot of things out of my life or delegate a lot of things. Mm. Some of it cost money, but then I was like, you know what, if my time is worth X to grow the company, you know, it's worth it for me to kind of hire some things out. So just a couple like easy examples would be like shoveling the snow on our sidewalk is not something that I enjoy. And it would cause me to come home from work an hour earlier. And I found somebody to do it for $20, right? So I'm like, my time is worth more than $20. They're happy to do it and make $20. That makes a lot of sense, right? So that was sort of something in my personal life that I was able to outsource. But then even in my business life, it made it a lot easier to delegate tasks. I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with delegation, but it's really the only way to grow your business. And if you look at your time as having real value, you know, filling out forms or whatever it is probably not the best use of your time, right? So that's sort of the third thing is look at your time as billable, and that'll help you really focus on what activities you should be doing, right? Like lawyers do a great job, right? Like, you know, when I get a bill from my lawyer, it's like 0.2 hours, you know, 0.4, right? I'm like, man, like they're like down to the minute, right? And I feel like entrepreneurs should think about themselves that way too, right? Even though personally, I hardly pay myself anything. My value to the company is quite great, right? So just thinking about your time as billable, I think is a kind of a cool concept for entrepreneurs to think about.
Yeah, I think it's a really great concept. And one of the challenges that I know that I've had when I've gone through those exercises and really been trying to be diligent on it is like, okay, I know that my time is worth more than what I should be investing into this task, whatever that task is. Mm-hmm. But I get trapped sometimes in the, but it's going to take me so much time to train somebody to do that, it'll take just as much time to tell them what I need done as it is for me to just do it. And so I just jump in and try to do it. And it's false because I'm not creating that capacity then within the team. And that's really problematic. Mm-hmm. For yourself, how do you overcome that? Because that is something I think that a lot of entrepreneurs fall into that kind of trap. So how do you be like, no, goddammit, I'm going to have somebody else do this. As painful as it might be to get them trained up on it or to explain it to them or whatever. It's like, no, I'm not doing it.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the ways that I look at it is the longer term thinking, right? So I'll think, okay, like you're totally right. Like there are some tasks where I'm like, you know what, I can do this in 5 minutes. I know somebody else, it's going to take them 15, but then how I think about it is if it's something that I'm literally only ever going to do once, I'll probably just do it. But if it's something that happens every week or every month, that's how I get it through my mind. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I can do it quicker. But the problem is I do this every month and that time really adds up, right? Actually, that just made me think of a great book that I read a couple of years ago called Atomic Habits. And it's all about that. Yeah. And it's all about how just tiny little decisions compound. And so that you can actually see on the wall behind me this quote, and it says, time magnifies the margin between success and failure. It will multiply whatever you feed it. And that quote has been a real game changer for me in what you're just talking about, where I look at that 5 minutes and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot. But 5 minutes every week over 40 years or whatever your career span is, right? That's huge. Yeah. And so if I can take 5 minutes and even go home 5 minutes earlier and spend time with my kids, right? Or whatever is most important to you, it doesn't seem like a lot, but that over time makes a huge difference, right? Think about compound interest on an investment, right? When you run those like compound interest calculators and you do 20 years versus 40 years and you're like, holy shit, like I wish I started investing when I was three, right? So that's sort of how I think about it. And then I'm like, even though it's not a lot of time over the long term, it is.
Yeah, completely. And so one of the things that I would throw out there as well, a little bit of a piece of advice is to try to do that analysis, you know, at the very least quarterly, but if you can do it monthly, like reviewing your time, And just being like, okay, well, which ones of these things can I offload? Mm-hmm. I think that's really, really important, because it's amazing how quickly some things creep back in, or just new things are there and you don't really think about it until you sit down and really analyze your time and where you're spending that. And it's like, okay, yeah, no, I need to offload something. And that, as an example of my own, so doing this this series, so Amplify Your Business, we were only recording, once a week is what our distribution was for the first like 2 years almost of this. Yeah. And then we ratcheted it up to 5 days a week. And so some of the things that I was doing when it was just once a week, well, it didn't take that much time. And so mm-hmm. I was, on the administrative side of the podcast part of it. So whether it's, downloading the recording or filling out some of the background information that I need for the interview and so on. And it's like, once I ratcheted it up to five, it's like, holy crap, this is taking a lot of my time. Yeah. And so it's like, okay, I should have, even when it was once a week, should have had that offloaded, yeah. But I didn't, and I could get away with it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But once it ratcheted up, well, then there was just no way about it. I had to offload it. And so that's the thing where it's like, until you really think about and run through that exercise, is okay, what can I distribute to the team? You'll never really get everything off your plate that you should mm-hmm. be, because it is so true. And we know this as entrepreneurs, because we're told this all the time, that we need to be focusing on building the business as opposed to being working in the business. Yep. And that's our highest value that we're ever going to get out of our time. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to slip back into the doing, right?
It's tough though, right? I mean, money-wise too, right? Like, I really struggled at the beginning making those first couple hires, right? Like, I'm like, I know I need to hire somebody so that I can focus on the business. But if you don't have the funding, like it can be really challenging, right? And so that, I think one of the best ways to kind of get started on that is the outsourcing of the little tasks. Like I said, the lawn mowing or the snow plowing or whatever, right? You don't need to hire a full-time person, obviously, but if you're like, look, I can afford $100 a week on outsourcing, find 5 hours where you can hire somebody for $20 an hour to go do those things, and then allocate that time and say, you know what, I'm going to work on my business for those 5 hours, right?
Yeah.
I think obviously, like the biggest outsource I did was hiring my head distiller, right? That was kind of the big one, but that, there's a salary and all that, right? So if you're like a startup, kind of shoestring budget, obviously it's going to be tough to hire full-time people. But if you can just find like 4 or 5 tasks where it's like, look, I can pay somebody $10 or $15 or $20 or whatever to get this done. Even that makes a huge difference, right? Those little blocks of time.
Yeah. It's incredible. So I'm really curious, what was the inspiration for Fort Distillery? Why did you start this business?
Yeah. So, I've always kind of had that entrepreneurial drive, like growing up, I would try to sell like the herbs and the raspberries from my parents' garden, or I used to raise like rabbits and chickens. We lived out in the country, right? And try to sell them or sell the chicken eggs or whatever. So I always kind of had that drive. I went to university for chemistry. So I went to the King's University here in Edmonton, got a chemistry degree. But I filled all of my electives as much as I could with business courses, kind of realized throughout my degree that was really my passion. And then after my degree, I was working in agriculture for the government as a crop inspector.
Okay.
But again, I always kind of had this entrepreneurial thing in the back of my head. I was like, I want to do a business. And I would have these ideas, and I would kind of run them through a test and say, okay, using a coffee shop as an example, right? I was like, oh, should I open a coffee shop? And then I would kind of say, do I want to, would I quit my, well-paying government job to go run a coffee shop? Mm-hmm. Nah, I'm not that passionate about it, right? So that was sort of my litmus test. And then one day I read an article in a chemistry magazine about a bunch of chemists opening a distillery in Ontario. And I thought, hey, I'm a chemist. I like booze. Like, this seems pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so I went and talked to a bunch of other distillery owners here in Alberta. So that would have been in 2017. It was a new industry. It was growing. Everybody who was in the business seemed to be doing well and enjoying it. And so in 2017 is when we made the decision to open the distillery. And we opened in September of 2018. So it took about, 10 months-ish. of research and testing and all that good stuff. But yeah, that was kind of the inspiration behind it, was the chemistry side of it. And I said, hey, I've got this skill set of chemistry, also the agriculture. So I, you know, have access to grains and stuff like that, raw materials. And I'm passionate about it, right? I've always enjoyed a good scotch or a unique rum or gin or whatever, right? And yeah. So when I looked at the industry, I said, you know, would I quit my steady government job for this? Heck yeah. So it kind of checked all the boxes for us. And yeah, that's how we got started back in 2018.
Yeah, really cool. And so like you mentioned at the outset, that it's like the spirits industry has really, and distilleries have really started to follow in the footsteps of the craft brewery industry. And that's really starting to mature. I mean, I think we're 160, 170 different breweries now in Alberta. What do you think is the future for the distillery side of things? Do you think it's going to, like, are you at the apex yet of that trend, or is there still lots of room for it to grow?
I think we're on the upward curve right now. There's a ton of new distilleries opening. I think there's probably already too many. So I think it'll follow probably a similar trend to breweries, where a whole bunch open, and then sort of the gold good ones will stay, and a lot will not necessarily close, but just never kind of reach that level of big business, I guess, if you will. The thing with distilleries versus breweries is just the volume, right? Like, people just drink up way more beer. Like, it's just, that's just a fact, right? And and also going to a brewery, a lot of breweries can have like a brew pub in them, right? Like the volume that you can sell from your pub inside your brewery is quite a bit higher than what most distilleries would sell from their cocktail lounge. So there's definitely a lot of them. And it kind of depends, right? If you want to have a distillery that just sells, you know, some bottles locally and maybe just supports the owner or whatever, you know, that's probably still doable. To build a larger scale distillery, that's a lot harder, right? There is a lot more competition now. If I was looking at the market again today, I probably wouldn't open another distillery unless I had a really unique idea, or a lot of funding. But it's definitely becoming pretty saturated for sure. Like, so, there's like five distilleries in St. Albert. Like, it's, you know, I'm not saying anything against those distilleries in St. Albert, but just like, it's a lot of distilleries in a smallish city, right?
Yeah, totally. And so knowing that the concentration is getting to the place where it's like, oh, okay, maybe there's a little too much competition there, or too many brands competing for the same mind space, right, of the consumer. What are you doing differently now than what you did, say, in the earlier days when there wasn't quite as much competition there? Mm-hmm. How's that changing your marketing, changing your product mix, mm-hmm. the whole thing?
Yeah, totally. So a couple things I would say. First off, we think a lot more before we launch a product. Mm-hmm. Right, it used to be when we started, right, we're just like, we're going to do a vodka and a gin, right? That was just kind of what everybody did. It's what we did. You know, we were sort of in the first probably 20 distilleries that opened, and so there was still room for that, and we did okay. Now when we go to launch a product, we make sure that we are solving somebody's problem. So instead of just saying, hey, we're going to launch another gin, you know, we look at the market and say, you know, is there, you know, do we really need another gin here, right? Like, is that really what people are asking for? So like Tumblr and Rocks is a good example of that, right? There was, you know, like I said, basically one international competitor that, you know, had a ton of shelf space. And other than that, really nobody. We were kind of the first ones in Canada to really focus on that. Our Mountain Pass whiskey is one of the few Canadian whiskeys that's a decent price point, right? We're not selling it for $100 a bottle. And so we're much more conscious about what we launch and make sure that there's actually room for it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. Another thing we've done is we've expanded quite a bit into other markets. So we distribute now into 7 states, and then we're launching in Connecticut in September. So that'll be 8. So we're doing quite a bit of work in the US and in some other provinces. And that obviously allows us to diversify and not get all of our revenue from Alberta.
Yeah.
And then we're also looking at different marketing, right? Instead of just doing Instagram ads, we're finding sponsorships and working with restaurants and doing events and kind of more unique deals, right? Instead of just saying, here's our vodka, go buy it. We're saying, or our whiskey actually is a better example, right? We're the Well Whiskey of Rogers Place, the preferred whiskey partner of the Edmonton Oilers, right? So we're doing bigger things and we're going after different markets than the brand new distilleries are. So I'd say there's a lot of new distilleries opening. A lot of them aren't funded enough or experienced enough to go after those kind of bigger deals that we're going after now. So it's hard to say to a new distillery, oh, well, you should just go bigger, right? Unless they're well funded. But that's kind of what we've done, right? And I mean, we've had the luxury of being in the business now for 4 years to get to this point. It would have been impossible for us on startup.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm really curious about your experience going into the States. So has that been much different than trying to get into other provinces in Canada? Like, is it pretty much the same nuanced?
It's both easier and harder. So it's easier in that, like, all of the provinces are run by the government, the provincial government. So Alberta is actually the only province where you can basically do whatever you want. You can launch anything. You know, if you were a distillery in BC, you can come into Alberta quite easily. All the other provinces are extremely hard to get into. You have to present to liquor boards. They often only have one or two times a year when you can make your presentation. You mostly get rejected. It's quite hard. In the States, in a lot of states, as long as you find a distributor, you can launch in that state. There's not as much government intervention. So that part is easier. But what's a lot harder is just that the states are so, each state is like its own little country in terms of what works and doesn't work. And so we work with a lot of distributors and some of them were definitely a mistake. And looking back now, I'm like, I never would have signed with them if I knew what I know now. And the marketing that we do in Wisconsin might not be the marketing we do in New York, right? So I say it's easier to get in, but it's harder to be successful, right? Here in Alberta, there's restaurants down the street I can go sell to. In the US, I'm relying on my distribution partners and it's further away, right? So unless you're big enough, which we're not, like, we don't have our own staff in the States yet. We're working with distributors. Unless you have your own kind of people, boots on the ground, it's pretty tough to grow. And so that's been one of my big focuses this year is on figuring that piece of it out. So I think there's a lot of growth opportunities there, but it's definitely something you have to put a lot of time into.
Yeah. So when you're marketing yourself down there, are you marketing yourself as a Alberta or Canadian, whiskey in the case of your whiskey and that, or I'm just wondering if that's the angle of differentiation down there.
It is for the whiskey. So with the whiskey, we do advertise it as Canadian. The whole story behind the whiskey is that we're using glacier water. It's very Canadian. The label has the Rocky Mountains on it, right? Like, that's the story behind that brand. So with that one, yes, it's a Canadian whiskey, clean water, quality grains, that whole story. With the cocktails, no. The cocktails, we don't market as a Canadian product. Like, it says on the bottle, probably made in Canada or whatever, but because there's less competition in that world, we market them a little bit differently as a great cocktail. We focus on that, like, kind of more lifestyle, that these cocktails are made to bring you together with your friends and to take camping and to go on adventures. If you look at our ads or our Instagram, a lot of it is people enjoying the cocktails together in nature. And so we've built a bit of a different story around that, where the Canadiana just doesn't, it's not quite as important. And so it depends. Those are our two main products, is the Mountain Pass Whiskey and Tumbler and Rocks. And so each one has its own sort of differentiation.
Yeah, really interesting. So now when it comes to your business, and like you're talking about, if you were to go back and do some things that are slightly different, knowing, what you know now, but what if you had an extra infusion of cash, say in day one, would that have changed anything that you would have done in terms of product development or marketing or market penetration strategies or anything like that?
Yeah, if I had more money, and knew what I know now, I guess it would have changed. If I had just had like $1 million and known what I knew then, which was nothing, it probably would have been
bad.
It would have been worse, right? I would have wasted it all on random garbage. Knowing what I know now, it definitely would have been different. Heck, even having just $1 million right now would be great. But yeah. So back then, a couple things that probably would have changed. I would have, like I kind of mentioned at the top of the show, I would have spent more money on marketing. So when we first started, we had a graphic designer that we just, you know, kind of paid by the hour, but I led it, right? I said, you know, this is what I want everything to look like. And then he built it. I built the website myself, our initial website. There was a noticeable switch when we hired like an actual professional marketing company, which would have been in 2020. A huge switch, but they're expensive, right? Like, you know, they're minimum $5,000 a month for a full service marketing company. So if I had had more money, I would have done that right off the bat, is hired a professional marketing company. I would have taken more time to figure out the brand story and how we present ourselves to the world. I would have done that. Another thing I would have invested in at the beginning would have been some more automated equipment. So that's been a huge game changer for us over the past 2 years, is, having some more automation in our system, right? It's just allowed us to be a lot faster, more efficient, have less packaging staff. So if I had had some more capital at the beginning, I would have done that. And then the final thing I probably would have done would have been to hire my own salesperson. So at the beginning, it was just me doing all the selling, but obviously that, you know, took me away from growing the business. I mean, selling is growing the business, but you know what I mean? And so we would have hired like an experienced brand manager, you know, kind of right off the top. Because again, once we hired a sales team, you know, we noticed that difference in the deals that they were able to bring to the table versus what myself with no liquor experience at that time. So those would have been the three things: spend more time on branding, more automation, and more on sales.
Yeah. I can see those all really paying off for any business that is, you know, in your space. But then also, like, when you extrapolate that, it's about, you know, the efficiencies. It's about, you know, having the right tools in place, regardless of what kind of business you're in, and the right people, whether that's, you know, you have to hire that out as contractors or as service providers, or whether that's internal, right? It really comes down to those as really big things that move the needle for any business. I'm just thinking, like, in terms of more almost like, if you were to be able to mentor your younger self. So let's say you're penning yourself a letter, and that letter you're going to deliver, you know, to yourself 4 years ago when you started, how would you mentor yourself at that point? What would be in that letter?
I think the number one thing, or one of the number one things, would have been my comment that I made earlier about finding a problem to solve. Mm. I think that's something that I overlooked, and that a lot of people overlook when they're starting a business, is, you know, they're passionate about a product, or they see everybody else doing it, and so that's what they do. So in our case, you know, we launched with a vodka and a gin, right? That's what all the other distilleries did. Those are, they're quick. They're, you know, fairly easy to make. So that's what we did.
Broad audience too, right?
Totally. But once you get into it, you kind of realize, okay, this is also what everybody else has.
Pretty crowded.
Also, like, the vodka category is huge, but it's basically like four brands that everybody buys. The gin category has like 500 gins. Like, it's crazy. So if I could look back and talk to myself, I'd say, slow down a little bit and actually go through a liquor store, talk to, you know, bartenders, and see if there's any opportunities or problems that you can solve, instead of just saying, here's a vodka or a gin, right? Because when we launched Tumblr and Rocks, which actually solves a problem, right, that you want to have a cocktail at home, but you don't have the ingredients, selling it became so much easier, because you can say, you have a problem, I have the solution, give me money and I'll give you the solution, right? Whereas you're trying to sell a vodka, it's like, here's a vodka, there's like 100 other ones, but you should buy mine, right? Because it's whatever, has, you know, special wheat in it or whatever, right? You know what I mean? Like, so I think that'd probably be one of the number one things I'd say to a younger Nathan starting his business. And that's the advice that I've given. You know, there's been a couple of people that I've I've chatted with who have opened distilleries. And that's sort of my number one thing is like, don't just do what everybody else is doing or what you're passionate about. Like what you're passionate about is important, but if you're really passionate about vodka, but nobody buys it, like who cares, right? Yeah. You know, find a problem to solve, because that even if it is a vodka, maybe it's a, I don't know, super premium vodka, because, you know, that's actually what people want and there aren't any on the shelf. You know, within crowded categories, you can still find those, you know, little nuggets of problem solving, but it just takes some more research and some more time. And so that would be, yeah, one of the number one things I would have said, because it took us, you know, we launched Tumblr and Rocks in 2020, we opened in 2018. So it's sort of 2 years of having a product that people wanted, but it didn't solve anybody's problems. And then it was definitely a night and day switch when we suddenly had a product that actually solved a problem, just in terms of sales and the ease of selling and marketing it too, right? When you know you're solving a problem, it becomes so much easier to write ads and stuff like that.
Totally. Now I am curious about, did you just kind of stumble into that as being, you know, these guys as being the solution to a problem that was in the market? Or after a couple of years, you're like, okay, I'm tired of banging my head against the wall on this and competing against all these other brands. I need to find a different way to, you know, do this. And so let me now really focus on the research part of it.
Yeah, it was number two. It was okay. After 2 years, I was like, you know what? I, you know, it's not like we were going bankrupt or anything. Like we would have been fine, you know, would have remained like a fairly small business, but I just said, you know what? This isn't what I want. I want to be a big business. And I know that with my current products, I'm not going to get there. And so it was definitely more of a specific search to say, okay, I know I need something that solves a problem. And so, you know, I pretty quickly, I was like, okay, probably something in the ready to drink arena. You know, I did a lot of research on canning and had a lot of ideas and you know, at one point we were going to do like a spiked cold brew, I think. We were going to do like a gin and juice. But then, you know, again, looking at that category and seeing, okay, there's already thousands of canned cocktails out there. And then we were like, okay, what were we going to do? We were going to do cocktails in big bottles and 750 ml bottles, right? Some of the we had a cocktail lounge here. And so we're like, well, maybe we can do like a bottle, you know, bee's knees or whatever. And then, so I started doing research on that. And then I stumbled on a company in the US doing the little 100 ml bottles. And that night, like I didn't sleep at all. Like I just tossing and turning. And I went into it because I immediately knew. I was like, that's it. Like I did the research. Nobody in Canada was doing it. There was like two companies in the US. I was like, that's the one. Boom. We can do it. We have bottles. We have spirits. Like nobody else is doing it. Let's go. And so the next day I came into the distillery and told myself, I was like, we're switching gears, folks. Like it's on to cocktails. And so it was definitely a deliberate search to say, okay, I need to find something that solves a problem. And it solved a bunch of problems, right? There was, I remember trying to sell our vodka and our gin to some licensed cafes, right? Because they all have craft beer. So in my mind, I was like, well, you have craft beer, you should have craft spirits. But they all said the same thing. They're like, yeah, we like craft spirits, but we don't want to make cocktails. It's too hard. It takes up too much space.
Yeah.
And so then kind of at that same time, I was thinking about, well, how can I make life easier for restaurants, right? And so it all tied in together because now we sell our 1.75 liter bottles to restaurants to save them time. So it was definitely a deliberate search.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's really, really great because I wasn't sure what your answer was going to be to that because some people just accidentally stumble into it.
And I think you can do it either way, really,
Oh, that's
but really I think cool. it's when you do that search, like what I did, it is easier if you've been in industry for a couple of years, right? Like I at least had a couple of years of experience to draw from. Yep. If I had tried to do that right at the beginning, you know, I probably would have had to hire a consultant or you know, a bartender or talked to a bunch of people, right? It definitely would have been more challenging. You know, I had the luxury of being in the industry for a couple of years, but you know, if you're an entrepreneur starting a business in a space that you don't have a ton of experience in, you know, highly recommend going and talking to the people that you're going to be selling to, right? Like in our case, it would be bartenders and liquor stores, right? If I should have gone back and actually gone to bars and talked to the bartenders and said, hey, like, what are you having a hard time sourcing right now? What's too expensive? What do you need more of, right? Talk to your customers, because the information they tell you will be super, super valuable.
Yeah. So I'm also really curious about what success looks like. Like, how do you define success? So the Nathan of 4 years ago, mm-hmm. your definition of success, I'd imagine, is slightly different than what the Nathan of today is. But I want to push this out. So Nathan of 10 years from now, mm-hmm. what is success? What will have had to have happened in order for you to feel like, you know what, this was success?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So two of my values in life are growth and freedom. And so for me to be successful, to have a successful life, I want to be involved in things that I can grow. And so, for the distillery to grow, to be even larger and larger, or, you know, if we're talking 10 years, maybe it's a different business, whatever it is. I really enjoy that growth piece, right? There's some businesses that you can be in where it's not all about growth. Like, for example, like real estate, right? It's kind of about growth, but it's more just like a steady check every month, right? I prefer something where I can build a product or build a service and grow it. So, you know, in 10 years, if I've been able to grow the distillery or other companies or whatever it is in 10 years, that'll be success. And then the other piece is freedom. So one of the things that I love doing is this kind of adventures. I'm big into hunting and fishing. And so I enjoy going out into the kind of the wilderness and doing that. You know, we go to BC. Last year we did a helicopter trip into the mountains and fished in the river. My wife and I are going to Virginia actually for 2 months in 2023, because I'm at the point now where I can work from anywhere. So I'll still be working while we're there, but you know, we can go somewhere a little bit warmer and by the ocean, and I can work. And so that to me is success, the ability to be able to choose to do that, right? And so I wouldn't get involved in something that tied me down to one spot. Anything that I do in my life will be to those two of my goals. This is that growth piece and that freedom piece.
Yeah, really cool. Well, it sounds like you're on the path to definitely achieving success. And so, I really enjoyed this cocktail. I love the story. I love the evolution of the business and what you've been doing there. And I think we've unpacked a lot of great learnings for mm-hmm. our audience. And so thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. So for those of you who are listening today, if you enjoyed this episode, head over to amplifyyourbusiness.ca. That's where you're going to find our archived episodes and all of our future ones as well. And if you prefer this via audio only, well, then you can find us on all of the major podcasting platforms. Just search Amplify Your Business in your favorite platform. And until next time, everybody have a prosperous day.